Today, let's finish a conversation about what it could be like to live in the world post-Roe.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So, up to this point, we've done two episodes regarding pro-life issues and seeking ways, and this, you know, fits the vein of what I've been trying to do in all of the episodes of this podcast, is promoting peacemaking in different ways. And in this case, you know, in the other two parts of this conversation, we've been sort of in elementary school. Today, we're graduating straight to college. This will be the more difficult part of the conversation for some of us to grasp how we approach the other side with, instead of spears outstretched, you know, hands outstretched. Is there a conversation that we can have? And that's where we're going directly today. I mentioned last time what we were ending on were the values that sort of underlie the pro-life position. The most obvious and direct from that one, just the value of human life, the dignity of human life, to things about the rule of law and equity and justice, those things that underlie the pro-life position. I mean, that's all there is to it. In talking about those, what I was pointing out last, and the very last thing I was talking about in the previous episode, is how those values converge. They really represent a single core of concepts that are at the base of the pro-life position. And obviously what I'm implying by that is that we may be able to find a common core of values that are shared between the pro-life position and the pro-choice position. I know that sounds absurd, but it's actually not absurd. It actually is there. And so again, at that core, the values that converge have to do with the equality that's intrinsic to every human being. This is the last thing I was saying last time. And whether that equality shows up as attitudes about the dignity of human life, or in the uniformity of the enforcement of law, or in equity regarding applications of justice, they all hinge on the equality with which we treat all people in the society. And by the way, in addition to that, we have to recognize that because in a society, when you start talking about equality, you're inherently going to have to deal with the reality that there are inequalities. Some people are taller than others, and others are, you know, bigger than others, and some are smaller, and some are weaker, and some are stronger, and some have more money, and some have less money. And how do you deal with that? Either you acknowledge it as some natural outcome, or you address it as some ethical problem that needs to be addressed, or it's a combination of all those things in between. And so in talking about that, recognizing that we have a society that's very much rights-based, so every individual gets to do everything possible within their sphere of freedom, as long as it doesn't keep other people from doing everything possible within their sphere of freedom, which tells you that in a rights-based society, you're always having to deal with the conflicts that emerge between the freedoms of individuals. You can have the freedom to go drink a milkshake, but you can't have the freedom to take your neighbor's milkshake from them, unless it's too big. I'm just kidding. So, but the point is that those conflicts inevitably emerge. They're not accidental. They're not quirks of a rights-based society. They are what defines how we understand ourselves as a rights-based society. And so, and it's as simple as this. If, and I'm in the world of higher education, so President Criswell College, where we serve all kinds of students, but our goal is to serve students who want to give their lives away in ministry. And that, whether it's church vocational ministry or elementary education or psychology in a clinic or counseling or whatever, or if they're going into public policy type stuff. And we focus on all of those different things. But it's with an appeal to students who want to give away their whole lives, their whole ministry, their whole career to God and the people he called us to serve. They're not in it for themselves. And some people have a sense of that kind of calling. We are perfect for students like that. Now, serving students like that means that we don't put out students who are going to spend their lives making the priority how much money they can generate. That's not their priority, which means it would be really hard for them to pay significant student debts. Fortunately, we don't generate a lot of student debt, and we've received recognition for that as well. But the reason I'm saying all of that is because we give a lot of scholarships away. So let's say that we provide scholarships that are restricted to impoverished students. If we do that, if we say we're going to give some scholarships away that are need-based, is how they're referred to, well, then that excludes some wealthy people from receiving those scholarships. And that would seem to some people inequitable. Well, that's not fair because a wealthy person ought to have the same access to the same scholarships. But that person already has money, and so it sort of makes sense to do it in that sense. And so, therefore, we recognize that if we weren't to offer those need-based scholarships, we would be excluding some impoverished students from the opportunity to get the higher education that they want. So you can see how, even if it's not a violent conflict or not one that you have to maintain discord about, it creates conflict when you have rights that are recognized between people. And this is not about an economic zero-sum game. It's not because we don't have enough money to give other scholarships. We give a lot of scholarships that are not need-based, by the way. It has nothing to do with that. This is about where concepts are inherently opposed to each other. If this is a right, then that impinges on the rights of these other people if they're defined that way. So it's how you're going to define rights that comes into the question. And that's what we're going to have to deal with in this part of the conversation. And for a long time, we've not listened to anyone on the pro-choice side, and I'm saying we being pro-life, have not listened to anyone on the pro-choice side make arguments that the conflict of rights that's imposed on them has anything to do with something other than the things we have heard. In other words, what we have heard are the kinds of claims that we regard as false on the face of it. I mean, we as a pro-life person, when someone says to me, well, prenatal lives are only tissue, you know, it's just a clump of cells, I just know that's false. I mean, I've seen sonograms, I've seen how they develop, and I know the difference between something that's totipotent and something that's not, something that can become a full human being and something that can't. And it's obvious it's not just a clump of tissue, and it's got a different, you know, whatever. So I view that as false prima facie. Or when someone says, well, you know, I think pregnancy is really categorized as a malady. It's some kind of illness anyway, if insurance companies are saying. I listen to that, and I go, that's just false. I mean, it's not a disease. This is a part of human progress. And if we don't, if we stopped having babies, we would cease to exist as a species. That's not true for malaria. Oh, if no one gets malaria, you get the idea. So I look at those claims as false prima facie, which is the way we've treated every claim from the pro-choice side, but not every claim from the pro-choice side is directly about abortion itself. A lot of the claims have nothing to do with that. And I realize it sounds absurdly optimistic to say we're going to find common ground, but I think there is common ground to be had there. And it requires us to acknowledge the possibility that there's more to being pro-choice than being pro-abortion. And I get it. As I'm saying this as a pro-life person, I understand why, as pro-life people, we want to immediately hedge that by saying, well, then the pro-choice people are going to have to recognize that there's more to being pro-life than being anti-abortion. We're actually for life. Yeah, we want to help people on the pro-choice side realize that we are more than anti-abortion. We actually are pro-life, and we've been trying to make that case for a while. But doing that means we need to back up and say, you know, maybe there are arguments from the pro-choice side that aren't just pro-abortion, but have to do with something other than abortion. Those we should be able to listen to and then grasp what's actually going on in this conversation. But we haven't been willing to do that. And in order to do that, I realize that I have to make a couple of assumptions. Even in order to consider listening to the other side on the issue of abortion, that's such a hot spot in our culture, I am asking for a couple of assumptions to be embraced. Number one is one that I've talked about before when we've talked about critical thinking and how you form arguments, that anytime you're forming an argument, it has to be formed on the basis that you share common ground with the other person, because the premises to an argument require that you have some commonality of opinion. Well, you believe this and this. Well, therefore, you ought to believe that. The conclusion can only be drawn if you have some common ground. So on that basis, I'm saying we have some common ground. We share a government. We have a common society. We speak a common language. We have common cultural backgrounds. We have common experiences and so on like that. So there is room for us to have a conversation on common ground with the other side in the culture. And then secondly, and this is the other assumption that you have to embrace with me if you're willing to go forward on this part of the conversation, and that is that the extremes don't define the center of the other side or of our side. If we're going to define the debate based on the extremities of the two sides, then we are only going to perpetuate the divide. There's no way to get around that. I mean, it's too great a divide. But the extremes don't define the middle of this issue. And so on either side, the extremes of the pro-life movement don't define the pro-life movement. They help shape it, but they don't define it. And the extremes of the pro-choice movement do not define the pro-choice movement. They do shape it, admittedly, but they don't define it. And so if we're willing to talk about the core of the two sides, what I'm saying is that those two cores are actually common. That's where the common ground lies. If you were to make it into a globe, I would be saying the North Pole, pro-life, the South Pole, pro-choice, or you can flip them, I don't care. If you have some prejudice against poles, that's fine. But whichever way you say the poles, I'm saying both of those poles share a common core to the globe. We are attached to the same core. And finding that's not as difficult as you think. So is it possible that opposites like that can share core values? And the answer is absolutely yes. Feminism is a basis for much of the pro-choice argument, not all of it, but much of a pro-choice argument. But I want to talk about feminism separately for just a second. Forget the pro-choice argument for a moment. Feminism is an example of how wildly divergent views on what should happen can actually be based on a common core. So, feminism ranges wildly in how it addresses things. There are people who want to address gender by erasing it. You know, there are no genders whatsoever. And then there are people who want to address gender bias by saying women are better than men. And so we want to focus on feminine attributes and characteristics in defining our ethics and our legislation. There are feminists who range wildly in their opinions of how to resolve or overcome history's and culture's male bias. But feminism is always about overcoming history's and culture's male bias. That's a common core value in feminism. So that's what I'm saying is possible for us to recognize in something that's as wildly different as the pro-choice and pro-life sides, and yet share a common core. And actually addressing that beginning with feminism is not a bad way to come at it, because either way feminism is approaching things, on, you know, the one side of erasing gender or the other side of emphasizing feminine gender. And again, those are two extremes on the feminist argument. They're not the middle of the feminist argument. In both of those extremes, I'm saying you can find a common core, in the same way that when you recognize that all of those things are brought together, all those feminist views are brought together, they are ultimately saying we want to overcome men's injustices against women historically, and not just individual men, but sort of a patriarchal society or a hierarchical society against women in those cultures and in the development of history. And so feminism as a movement is constantly advocating for victimized or subjugated women, and I realize that's only one way of expressing it, and in some ways could be an offensive way of expressing it. I don't mean for that to be the case. I'm simply pointing out that the movement is about taking up the cause of people who deserve advocacy, who need someone to overcome power structures that are against them. And by the way, that's just like, so the common value here, the pro-life movement's advocacy for victimized unborn children. What we're doing is saying these voices have not been heard historically, and we want them to be heard. We're saying it about the unborn. They're saying it about women who have been subjugated. You can disagree that women have been subjugated. I don't think you should, but you can disagree that women have been subjugated, but still acknowledge that the basis to their argument is that every person ought to be represented, and if they've been excluded from power structures, then someone ought to step up and give them voice. Both of us are saying that. I'm saying it about the unborn. They're saying it about women. We have something in common that we're sharing. You're right. Subjugated people, victimized people, powerless people deserve someone to represent them. In the same way, and so the goal then of the pro-choice position, if it's to end the oppression of women, which, by the way, I realize definitionally brings up its own conflict, because we would say, well, it's not the oppression of women to keep them from doing, you know, from having abortions, because abortion is just, and oppression is about using force to impose something that's unjust. And we're never going to say, as a person who believes that we're saving the life of a little baby in the womb, I'm never going to say that it's unjust to protect that child's life. But that's not the issue here. It is the issue ultimately, but that's not the issue if we're going to open the conversation for dialogue. To acknowledge that there may be other reasons as well than a woman simply saying, and no, I there may be women like this. Nobody is sitting down and saying, well, you know, I'm sure looking forward to ending this life. Nobody's doing that. So what is it that's generating this desire for a freedom from pregnancy that causes so many people either to be willing to say, I am willing to take that life, or to say, I'm not going to acknowledge there's a life there. I'm going to go have this procedure and I'm going to take care of it. There's something else there. There's some reason that 3,000 women every day, 1 million women a year, are deciding that the best solution to their unplanned pregnancy is to end it rather than endure it. There's some reason there. And again, it's not just people saying, I want to end life. That's just not the case. So what is that? And if I can just hear it, I don't have to agree that it's unjust. Surely I can just hear why they believe it's unjust for them to have to go through this pregnancy. And if I can, maybe I can figure out where we do have common ground. Maybe I can't, but maybe I can. My argument here is that I think we can. So again, I realize we have to do a lot of work on understanding what the word oppression means, and we might be resistant to that. But if you get it beyond the ending of the life for a moment, and by the way, the only reason we're able to have this conversation right now is because, and this is why I believe we can open our ears to hear the other side beyond the lives that are involved, because the overthrow of Roe v. Wade takes that requirement that people be able to end that life out of its protection in law. So now with the law not saying, hey, abortion is a protected right, if that becomes the case, then we have the ability to back up and go, hey, there's a life there that needs to be protected. So let's figure out what's going on that makes you say, I don't want to protect that life, or I don't want you to make me save that life. Let's figure out what's going on, because law is no longer forcing open the door to abortion, if Roe v. Wade actually is overturned, that is. And so what I'm saying to you is basically this. We've been arguing for 50 years, ad infinitum, that protecting prenatal life makes abortion restrictions right, that it makes it just. And honestly, some of those arguments have worked. But they have only worked, in my experience, which is long and deep, they have only worked with women who were pregnant. But they have responded, and with women who might be anticipating becoming pregnant. They have responded. I was shocked one time. I was teaching a bioethics class, and there was a demonstration around Roe v. Wade time of year, you know, mid-January, with people with placards out with those really grotesque images of post-abortion babies, you know, the terrible tragedy that happens there. And so just these really gory, bloody pictures that they were marching with in the streets and the little roads that were in the middle of this campus. And so I said in my bioethics class, have any of you been persuaded by that? I thought they would all say no. I thought everyone would say no. No, nobody's been persuaded by this. I bet 20 hands out of 80 came up in the room and said, I did. I kind of changed my mind about abortion. So I'm not saying that none of that was effective. I think it has been effective. What it hasn't been effective on is changing the mind of advocates on the other side, people who are working on public policy and promoting it and all that kind of stuff. And you can say, well, those people are just paid professional whatevers. No, they're not. They're people who care very much about their cause and they're ideologically driven and so on. And it hasn't changed their minds. And therefore, the public policy debate has stayed in the same place. I'm still glad, and I'm not saying that's the best approach, but I think that is a fairly weak approach, and yet it worked to point out that we are talking about real babies here, and that's why sonograms are so effective as well. So I love that, and I don't want to back off of that at all. I want us to constantly remind mothers that we are talking about mothers and children and allow that to have its impact on the individuals that are involved. I want that there. But at the same time, I know if we're going to reshape public policy for the future, then we have to recognize a completely different set of issues that are driving that public policy to require us to keep abortion available when what we should be doing is saying, I think we can hear those issues and begin to address those issues without having to make abortion available. And that's the point. The issues creating the context where abortion restrictions are seen as oppressive don't require us actually to make abortion available to solve those inequities. And let's just grant it for a moment, just for the purpose of debate. Let's say they're legitimate inequities, and I think there are some that are there. But some of those don't require abortion in order to be addressed. Those we should be hearing. And so here's the difficulty of getting there. We've built these structures into the debate that keep us on opposite sides of the wall and keep us from hearing each other. So if I say, hey, I'm pro-life, and I'm going to go talk to a pro-abortion, pro-death person, then I'm categorizing, I'm pigeonholing a person on the other. And if you think I'm exaggerating or caricaturing here, I'm not. That's what people do all the time. They say, well, those pro-death people over there. When we do that, we are saying we don't want a dialogue. We don't want the door open for a conversation. We simply want to caricature and pigeonhole and isolate and cordon off a whole segment of the society and say, you can't be a part of this discussion. And they do the same thing. And when I say they, I just mean broadly the pro-choice side on the advocacy level. They're saying they don't call us pro-life. They say we are anti-abortion or we're anti-women or we're anti-reproductive rights or whatever it is. And I understand why they do it. And we're doing the same thing. So it's an argument based on rhetoric. There's a truth. We talked about this in an episode on critical thinking as well. There is a truth to the fact that whoever defines the terms wins the debate. But it doesn't mean you win the debate factually. It doesn't mean you win the debate honestly. It just means rhetoric is really important. And so we're trying to win the rhetoric debate while we're doing all of this right now. But that's not right. Those epithets, and they are epithets, you know, where we say, oh, they're pro-death. It's a way of us minimizing the value of that other purpose. Those epithets actually are characterizing much larger populations, much larger demographics, only in terms of their very small extremities. So we're saying there, you know, it's like saying every Democrat in Congress is, I don't know, AOC, whatever the initials are for the one that's more radical up in New York, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or something like that is how you say her name, right? So it's like saying every Democrat in Congress is that person. Or like saying every Republican in Congress is, what's her name, Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm not any better at this side than the other side. But the point, nor do I want to be. My point, and I'm not saying those are equivalent or morally equivalent. I don't know enough about them to say anything much about them at all. But to say those are extremes. They don't define the middle of the party on either side. And yet we choose to do that. When we debate, we just want to debate against that extreme. We could do that with the pro-choice issue, with the pro-life issue. But all we're doing is cordoning off a huge portion of our population and saying your views don't matter. It's the view I've caricatured you to be that matters. And so we create a straw man out of them and don't have an honest conversation. And so this is why I said the extremities do not define the center of these issues. So for instance, on the really conservative side of the pro-life issue, you can be in favor of this, against it. I'm not saying you're a crazy person for believing this at all. On the really conservative side of things, there are people who believe that contraceptives should be illegal or should be banned. Now, that's not the center of the pro-life position. Whether you agree with it or not, that's not the normal pro-life position. And by normal, I mean center, the core of it. In the same way that there are people on the extreme of the pro-choice side who oppose any restriction even on infanticide. I find that insanity. And yet, they're the extreme. They're not in the center of the pro-choice movement. Not if you're honest about it. And so, again, those peripheries, they do have an influence. So I'm not saying it's not important or that we don't have to discuss it at some point. We do have to discuss those things. But they are not the core. And we can have a conversation at the core that's more meaningful than that. And the idea that we can, the idea that we share values with the pro-choice side about the dignity that should be afforded human beings, even the dignity that should be afforded the pronunciation of the word dignity, by the way. That word deserves better treatment, doesn't it? Just by definition. So we can agree on the dignity that should be afforded human beings, the rule of law and how it should prevail, and that the oppressed deserve justice. Both sides agree on those three statements. We are talking about applying those to different parts of the population, but we are talking about those three things. And the fact that we're uncomfortable hearing me say that tells you how far the divergence has come in our culture and how ensconced that system, that self-destructive and persistent system of conflict is in our culture. But if we're ever going to escape dead center, if we're ever going to, and by the way, dead center is not a good place to be. That center where we occupy right now because we think Roe v. Wade's going to be overturned, or if you're listening to this after it's been overturned, okay, it's been overturned. And so we say, well, we have the high ground now. We've got the center place right now. We occupy that center no more securely than the people who were on the other side did before Roe was overturned. We're just waiting for the next election or the next court or the next whatever is going to happen. If we want to get off of that dead center, then we have to find a path forward which doesn't require the other half of the population to repent or cease to exist. There has to be an option where we can hear why they're bringing their causes forward the way they are. So for decades, I have been, and this has been the nature of us. We've been unwilling to acknowledge anything in this side of hearing their arguments. We've been unwilling to hear anything about why abortions take place other than that people want sexual license, they want to do whatever they want to do, and they just want convenience. So they're just looking for an easy way out. And I understand why we didn't want to hear anything other than that, because anything other than that would have given ground to the other side. Oh, there are significant reasons for it. I get it. In the same way, the other side didn't want to hear anything from us other than that we didn't value reproductive freedom and we didn't value women's freedom and all we valued was controlling fertility. I understand that they don't want to hear anything other than that because doing something other than that might give ground to the other side. So we just rejected all of those considerations outright. But that belief that there's no legitimate ground for any claim from the other side creates no path forward, creates no option for a future in our country, not a single option for a future in our country that has a really safe place for prenatal life. There's no future for that. And I want a future that's sustainably safe for prenatal life and where there can actually be respect for that life in the society. So it should be obvious from the beginning that what I'm trying to advocate for, and believe me, I get that all three of these episodes together only comprise an introduction to the options for how to address this. And I will add, we will add more to the layer that I'm about to add right now. I'm just going to give one tiny example of how to do this. But overall, what I'm inviting is just broadly this.
that we begin hearing, that we begin listening to and understanding the other side of this debate. And I get it. I can't require that a pro-choice person listen to me. I don't have any grounds for saying to them, you should trust me. You should believe that I'm going to speak in a way that will actually be respectful of you. I get that I don't have any grounds for getting a person like that to listen to me. But actually, I do have a means for hoping that they will listen to me. But it doesn't begin with me speaking. The ground is the ethic that I actually do hold at the core of my being, from Matthew 7:11, you know, the golden rule, or from Leviticus 19, the great commandment, the requirement that every human be treated with equal dignity and provided equal treatment, meaning that when I look at any other person, I have to say whatever I expect from myself for them, I should expect from them for me. So if I want them to listen to me, I've got to listen to them. We've talked about this before. That expectation only begins one way being realized in the world, and that's me listening to them. And if I do, then I have every reason to believe that they may begin to listen to me as well. Now, so let me give you an example. And I'm only going to give one example right now, but I am telling you that we'll have to do an episode upcoming, either next or soon, to add layers to this of where this conversation could go. But I'm just going to give one example that's obvious to me as president of a college. I deal with this in our administration, and we have pretty good policies in place, but I think they will expand as we look forward to how to do this even better. So let me give you an example. What I'm describing for you is the ability to listen to a pro-choice person say, well, you know why? I think you ought to allow a woman to get an abortion if she wants to, because, and then instead of just assuming that what they say next is, because we don't value unborn lives and because so on, I'm going to assume that what they're going to say is not necessarily actually going to require abortion, but does require those of us who have advocated against abortion to hear enough to offer a better solution. So here's an example. I know that very often the reason women are considering an abortion is because of what it's going to do to their career, because they're looking at the opportunities that they have for work, and they know that when they're going into a workplace, one of the things that's being considered is, what's it going to mean for us if you get pregnant and leave work? You know, if you're in the middle of a case, if you're a lawyer and you have to leave it to somebody else, or somebody else has to take up the workload and so on like that. And so when people go in for an interview, if they sense in a workplace that you're going to favor someone who's not going to get pregnant and need to take 3 or 6 months off to take care of a baby and then may come back for the career or may decide to go ahead and stay home with their baby, if that's what they perceive, then of course they're going to say the only place to have an equitable workplace is going to be to have a workplace that doesn't favor people who can't get pregnant. You need to have a workplace that's amenable to someone who might get pregnant. Now, this is just a base layer. Just to say, okay, then we need to and if I just hear that and say, oh, yeah, well, I guess I can understand that. And I know women who have addressed exactly this. I know pro-life women who have said, well, I lost my career because I got pregnant, I had a baby, and you know, by the time I came back, the work, it just wasn't open for me anymore, and I wasn't able to do it anymore. And they're not complaining. They're saying, I chose family, I get it, that's the cost of making my choices. But that acknowledgement means that a woman who's saying, I don't want to have to decide against my career in order to have a family, I get it. You can say, well, you don't have a choice. You got to make a choice. You got to pick one or the other. But you don't say that to men. You don't say men have to pick between having a family or having a career. You say, no, you can have a family and just keep your wife at home. Do you hear how that might come across or actually be inequitable to someone who's on the other side of this issue? Please hear it. It's fairly obvious, right? Okay, so if that's the case, then what do we do in response to it to say, well, you know, here, let's approach this as people who are pro-life and want to find a pro-life solution to that kind of problem? So if an employer is, so think of it this way. If an employer is thinking twice before hiring a pregnant woman or a young wife, you know, they're thinking, oh, well, the insurance costs are going to go through the roof and maternity leave is going to cut into their productivity and they're going to end up making a decision, may not even come back. And so we've done all this investing and training in the person and then we don't end up with them as an employee anyway. If an employer thinks twice before hiring a pregnant woman or someone who could become pregnant, then a pregnant woman has a reason to think twice about that pregnancy or about how the employer might regard or actually value the life that she could potentially carry. Isn't that, I mean, that's a fair statement. You say you're pro-life, but you're not willing to support me through the process of bringing a little life into the world. So you would think that it would be obvious then that if we're going to advocate for life, we would also advocate for hiring standards that are oblivious to pregnancy or even favor pregnancy. I don't know which way you want to go with it. And if you say, well, what would that mean? You know, hiring standards that are oblivious to, well, the obvious one, that you don't ask questions about whether somebody intends to have a child or not, things like that. But then the less obvious ones, like providing ample maternity leave. But important here, maternity leave won't solve the problem. I mean, that's good, so women can take time off without a penalty. That's nice. But what you really need is ample family and paternity leave. So that if men are going to have a baby in their family, they're going to take as much time off as a woman is going to take off. And I know families who have split their time. So the wife's going to take off 3 months, and then the husband's going to take off 3 months or a month or whatever they have for their maternity, paternity, family leave, whatever you call it. And they've split it between two different employers in order to be able to give 6 months at home with a kid. And the employers have embraced that idea. That's a pro-life setting. That's where you're putting your money, where formerly a lot of people would have said only our mouths were. Now, if you say, and we can't afford that, I don't know, can we? I mean, can we afford to say we're pro-life, but we don't want to help you if you're the one who's going to carry that life? Is that really what we want to say? Now, I'm not, look, if you're thinking to yourself, oh, he's introducing socialism. I didn't say anything about government, nothing about a requirement or a regulation. I'm just saying a pro-life employer ought to do it. And if the government needs to enforce it or doesn't need to enforce it, have your own debate about that. I'm not even talking about that. I'm just saying to you as a pro-life employer, wouldn't you want an environment where people would feel supported if they're going to bring a life into the world? And doesn't that give you a different footing for a conversation with someone who thought that the only way to have an equitable workplace was to provide abortion as an option for people who get pregnant? You see what I'm getting at? We can have this discussion. I don't even know that that's the right resolution to this part of the discussion. It's just one resolution we could begin to discuss without having to compromise one tiny little bit our commitment to prenatal life. You understand where I'm going with this? The list for topics for such conversations could go on forever. I have no idea how far they would go. I know what some of those topics are, though. And obviously, the more dialogue you have, the more those topics would come up. And that's what I'm saying. We need to do another episode to just hit on what some of those issues might be, because we have, again, stood on opposite sides of the wall for so long that we haven't even heard the issues that have nothing to do with abortion if they're spoken by someone who advocates for abortion. Not because that issue has to do with abortion, but just because it's spoken by a person who also advocates for abortion. So we've ignored issues that we could actually address without having to compromise at all on the value of prenatal life. So again, the list of topics, who knows how long it will be. We'll do another episode and introduce some of those and just maybe open the door for us to be willing to have honest conversations with people who've been on the other side of this issue for so long. I recognize there's a risk in doing this. Like, for instance, I recognize that if I bring up like this, family leave, the one that I just brought up, I realize that if we engage in a serious conversation with people on the other side about this, they may use it as a wedge to say, oh, well, then you need government advocacy for that because women aren't going to have equal representation in the workplace unless it's enforced across all workplaces, and that means the government has to impose it, which means you do want this broader form of government imposing on private businesses and so on like that. And I'll hold my ground on that and say I don't ever think the better solution is government imposing more regulations in that way as a default. I'm not saying we should never have government regulations. I'm saying that's never my default position. I think there are always better answers than that if we're willing to go that direction. So I'll have that debate and I'll continue to hold that debate. The fact that someone would use it as a wedge to get in a more progressive agenda shouldn't keep me from engaging them on the part of the discussion where we actually can share common ground. I can't expect them to have emerged from the other side of the wall, you know, carrying flowers and open arms and saying, oh, come on over here, let's sing Kumbaya. I don't think they're going to trust me any more than I trusted them before I understood that we do have a lot of common values that we're ignoring. It's going to take time for them to come to this side. So to this side, meaning to the middle, you know, to where we can just discuss it, get on the bridge instead of be standing on the opposite sides of the chasm. So we've held this posture for so long. And I understand why, because, you know, a million lives a year were being lost in the process. So I don't begrudge the battles that have been fought. I'm not looking back and saying we shouldn't have done that. I mean, every life deserves to be protected, and I'm grateful for all the effort that was put into that. But I believe there's more to be gained, more for the value of life abstractly so that we respect life better, but also for the safety, for the protection of future little lives, concretely. If instead of maintaining this conflictual stance that we've had for so many decades, if we would take a stance inviting peace, where we open our posture and invite conversation. And admittedly, we can only do that from our side. And there is a risk. There is a risk that we will get to the middle and no one will be willing to meet us. I can't do anything about that. I can't control the other side. But the only other option is just to stay on this side, leave the barrier there, and leave the fate of those real lives just as uncertain then as our constantly shifting political winds are right now. My prayer and my purpose in this whole conversation is that we consider the benefits which might come were we to extend to every person on the other side of this issue the respect we want extended to every unborn child.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.